Hello, listeners, and thank you for hanging out tonight with me and my friends. Welcome to the show. Do you like to drink water? Of course you do. We all do. And if you don't, you need to be. I want to tell you about one of the coolest water bottles on the market right now, the Zendo Collapsible Water Bottle. One of the things that I have a hard time with when it comes to drinking water, whether it's at work or on the go, is what to do with the bottle. Yeah, you got your favorite old trusty water bottle that maybe your spouse or your mom bought for you for Christmas or your birthday, but this water bottle does something that no other before ever has. It's fully collapsible. Remember crushing a soda can down to a pancake for recycling? This is the same thing, only this container is made of 100% BPA-free food-grade foldable silicone, and it's 100% FDA-approved to ensure no odors and a clean water taste. It's leak-proof, watertight, and easy to clean, and each purchase comes with a collapsible straw. Whether you're climbing a mountain or spending the day in the office, Zendo is the only water bottle that you'll ever need. And you know what's really wild? This is not a paid ad. I picked up one of these, and I think it's so innovative that I wanted to tell you all about it. Head to ZendoOutdoors.com to learn more and pick yours up today. Mark Sargent, sir, welcome to the show. Thanks for giving me some time tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to do my best to make the interview sort of like a hybrid of questions you may have been asked a million times before, and questions you haven't maybe been asked or maybe haven't been approached a certain way so that we can sort of appeal to everyone that's going to be listening to the conversation tonight.
Okay.
So the first question has to do with sort of the importance of why. So like just before we get into Flat Earth, before we get into all that, a lot has been made sort of about the importance of why. So I want to start out asking you tonight about that. Can we talk about why you think it's important to sort of question what you read, what you're told, what you hear, etc., all that?
Yeah. Not just with Flat Earth, obviously. There's an old saying, and as I go through, I have a million sayings, which I love memorizing the good ones. And one of them, which I love, is trust everyone, but count your change. Which is, look, we all know there are lies and deception in just about every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, in business and politics and sports and entertainment and, yeah, even journalism and science.
Sure.
So when it comes to questioning things, that's why I end just about every interview with, you know, do your own research and ask questions. Don't take my word for it.
Right.
There seems to be this invisible line that we draw in the sand or wherever, which is, you know, there's stuff we believe in, you know, there's lies that we're willing to accept, and there's other ones we just don't want to look at.
Yeah.
Because there's this weird comfort zone, and it varies from person to person. And when you kind of get into the conspiracy world, it becomes a slippery slope. Once you believe a big thing, you know, that it's like, holy smokes. Once your hero has been taken down, that another saying is never, ever meet your heroes.
Yeah.
And so like in sports, you know, we see this all the time. It's like, when you see them for what they are, and all of a sudden they're accused of whatever, it's like, look, Pete Rose is never getting in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You know, that's just one of many, many people out there that have done things. And so with this, I grew up really, really naive in a sheltered environment in an island northwest of Seattle.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even think that people lied ever for anything, you know, on a big scale. You know, we all know there's little lies, but I never thought there was a big lie. And then I saw JFK in the theater,
yeah,
which will probably go down as Oliver Stone's greatest thing that he ever did. And I was like, and I saw it in a packed house in the theater when it came out. And when I walked out of there, I was like, holy smokes.
Yeah.
Something like this can happen. And right. Then you see the motivations for why. And so, yeah, this was kind of a natural progression. I have an opinion, and we don't have to get into them, obviously, but I have an opinion on just about every conspiracy you can think of.
Yeah.
Some I like, some I don't like, some I hate. Mm. And this was almost physically the last one I ever looked at.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I've talked to a lot of people, scientists, engineers, historians. We just covered Earhart. 15 years, I got off the Earhart case finally, and we're, you know, that's a big kind of can of worms in and of itself.
Yeah.
There's so many, take your pick. But one thing that always comes up is the importance of like reverse engineering a hypothesis, right? So like the best way to prove your hypothesis right is to first try and prove it wrong. So Can you talk about sort of what's been done, who you've talked to, what you've participated in? How did you get to this point?
As a matter of fact, that is one of the opening things that I throw at people, which is, you know, can I prove the flat earth to you right now? No, I cannot.
Yeah.
But can I create so much reasonable doubt in the globe? You know, because that's how everyone starts. We tear down the reason why our retention rate is so high in the flat earth community is because we didn't have to recruit anybody. Everybody started out hating it. It's like, oh, okay, well, I'll disprove it because I'll prove the globe. And right. Slowly but surely, you start chipping away at it to where there's nothing left. So even though you may want, kind of like the Matrix thing, even though you may want to go back to the globe after you're in a flat earth, there's nothing to go back to because you're the one that destroyed it in the first place. You, not us. It's not like we have a book like How to Tear Down the Globe. So when I looked into in 2014, I absolutely, and the documentary was absolutely accurate in that regard, was I hated it. Everybody hates flat earth. The saying is, I got into flat earth. I became a flat earther because I tried to disprove it.
Right.
And I sat on it for the better part of 9 months. I was way more stubborn than most people. And because I also didn't have a lot of material to work with, whereas now there's a lot out there.
Yeah.
And I got about February of 2015, that's when I gave up. And that's really what everyone runs into. It's that five stages of acceptance, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
Right.
And I got to that acceptance part in February of 2015, where I said, you know what? Screw it. I can't prove the globe anymore. I'm just going to make a series of videos saying, okay, here's why I think it's not a globe. And it's the biggest conspiracy ever. And somebody shoot me down and put it out on the internet, put my phone number, my email, my real name, every physical address, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
Put it out there and thought that it would get crushed. I honestly thought it was going to get crushed by some academic that caught something that I didn't. And then people started calling me, and the what really spooked me was the professionals that started calling me, all branches of the armed forces and engineers and air traffic controllers and pilots, and all these guys kept calling me saying, you know what, it's not that nuts, here's why.
Yeah.
And they would go into, you know, obviously nobody from aerospace, but everybody else that had anything to do with map making and transportation, they contacted me. And so any fear I had of the other shoe dropping went away within 3 to 6 months. So by the end of 2015, I was absolutely all in. Any doubts that I had were gone, to where now, you know, I put out challenges to scientists that are two and a half years old, and I'm getting nothing from them because there's nothing they can do.
What does it do for you when you put a series of videos out, you know, prove me wrong, you know, see if you can kind of, you know, we can walk this backwards, and you start getting folks that are reaching out to you that are, you know, are knowledgeable in certain fields and can basically sort of sympathize with kind of that point of view and say, hey, you know, this might not be that far fetched. Does that provide you like with an absolute sense of clarity at that point?
I wouldn't say absolute sense of clarity, but everything came into focus and a lot more quickly than I thought. What threw me though was that I wasn't getting, here's the part that got me, because I've got a testimony show list on my playlist on my YouTube channel of all these guys, you know, most of them, you know, were willing to at least go on air or have me read something on air.
Yeah.
Some of them were anonymous, but some of them used their real name, including the very first guy, a Navy missile instructor. But what was weird was none of those people, and here we are 4 years after these people were talking in some cases, nobody recanted and nobody rebutted against them. Meaning, I really thought that somebody from the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, somebody else would call me up and say, okay, the guy that you had on is really, really wrong. Here's why. And he'd go into a tear. And nobody reached out on that side of things. It just blew my mind. It's like, what? I mean, even if 10%, you know, like one out of every 10 people I talked to, if somebody would call me, that's where it's like, okay. Yeah, it was really nothing but positive reinforcement. I mean, of course you get people, I get, you know, the occasional troll emails, although trolls are notoriously lazy. So most of the troll stuff is in the, just in the YouTube comment section, which is one of the sayings I came up with is, it used to be, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all.
No. Yeah.
Now it's, if you can't say something nice, you're probably in the YouTube forums.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I hear that. Okay. Now another thing I was kind of thinking about last night as we were kind of preparing the talk, the documentary, I did get a chance to catch it when it went home and watched it last night, actually. So it's fresh in my mind.
Okay.
Yeah. It discussed confirmation bias, a pretty good amount. I mean, you hear that term a lot. It runs rampant in the Earhart case.
Sure.
I run into this, not only with that case, but other cases I've worked on. Do you think, just in a general sense, do you think confirmation bias is sort of a natural part of scientific work and research of any kind, really? I mean, is it built in?
Yeah, not just us, but the other side as well. Confirmation bias is, you want to see what you want to see, and you get jaded in your beliefs, no question. Which is why, but that doesn't mean that you can't be wrong. And I'm very, very open to that. Sure. It's like, look, people say, what if you're wrong? Will you shut it all down? I go, yeah, shut it all down. I'd love to go back to my normal life if possible. I don't think that's going to happen. But like the perfect example I'd give would be the, something I worked in the speech last year, which was the coelacanth fish.
Yeah.
C-O-E-L-A-canth, C-A-N-T-H. And it was a fish that every single scientist said it was absolutely positively dead, extinct for 70 million years.
Yeah.
Long time.
Yeah.
And then the British caught one off of South Africa, and then another one off of Mozambique and Madagascar and so on and so on. The National Geographic did a special, and they're swimming around with them right now. I mean, they're wily. You can't exactly, you're not going to catch them with a rod and reel.
But yeah.
The point is that every single scientist, because through their confirmation bias, it's like, well, there's the fossil record. They're in a fossil. Therefore, they are dead for 70 million years. And it still, to this day, really, really throws them. And so, again, not to go off into the weird stuff, but it's like when somebody says, oh, yeah, there could be plesiosaurs swimming around Loch Ness.
Yeah.
Beforehand, I'd be like, get out of here. But now, I was like, why not? And they said, well, because it's been dead for at least 100 million years. I go, well, yeah. So was that fish.
Yeah.
And so I go, my point is this, is that once it got caught, the bias had to change. And this is the part that drives me nuts about science, is it immediately became under the umbrella of science, where they said, well, it's obvious. It's a living fossil. They just made up that term, by the way. And it's like, it's in an evolutionary state of stasis. It's not evolving right now. It's like, what? You guys are just pulling this stuff out of your ass. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, you make a solid point. I want to get into it officially because, for those that might not know, for those who haven't seen the documentary, which of course we'll have a link to in the show notes tonight.
Sure.
If I ask you to give me an elevator pitch for Flat Earth, what does that sound like?
Okay. How many minutes do I got?
take your time.
Okay. So the elevator pitch for Flat Earth goes a little something like this. And you saw part of it. It was really the intro to the documentary, which I had nothing to do with the production of. I just happened to be the subject that they contacted first, and then through me, they got a hold of everybody else.
Gotcha.
Which was, you think you're on this little rock that's flying through in an impossibly empty universe at multiple... in multiple directions simultaneously, and that your life is an accident. You are absolutely insignificant. Nothing can be snuffed out by anything at any given time, and your whole existence is meaningless. We say that the old rules still apply, which is you're not on this tiny rock flying through space. You're just living in a building with walls and a floor and a ceiling, sort of like a snow globe, like a dome, a terrarium, planetarium, whatever you want to call it. And that's all there is. Everything you see in the sky is just a projection on the ceiling. And it's all literally just a production. To quote Shakespeare, all the world's a stage. Mm. You're on it right now. And it's not only that, but we, even our best and brightest, didn't figure it out. Didn't even figure it out completely until about 1960. Mm. And when they were exploring Antarctica. And when they did, and that was the United States and the Soviet Union back then, they said, you know what, let's keep this thing under wraps and keep it a secret for as long as possible until we can figure out how to introduce it to the public, because they certainly aren't ready in 1960.
Yeah.
And that's where we are now. It's 2020. Because look, if you wanted to stunt us or shut us down, they could have done that so easily. I mean, YouTube is what's promoting us basically full on for three straight years. And Google searches were promoting us whenever they could.
Yeah.
So that's where I think we are. I think it's being promoted out there. The infrastructure is already in place. You know, high-speed internet, social media, 6 billion smartphones.
Yeah.
It's all there. So that's where I think we are. I don't think we're actually pushing this narrative. I think it's being allowed to be presented.
Okay. Yeah. That's an interesting point. I mean, so like, and I guess it's a good segue into the next question, which is if you mentioned reasonable doubt earlier, I mean, what we do with Vanished is we take, you know, cases, my co-host and I, Jennifer, who's a criminal defense attorney out of Austin, we take historical mystery like the Earhart case, and there's multiple theories, and we put those theories in a modern day trial. And we say, you know, what evidence convinces you if you're sitting in a jury box? Everybody's convinced by different things, as you well know. I mean, it just depends on what is most convincing.
Right.
If you're going to court, let's say, and you're bringing your A game, and you have, what's the most hardcore evidence that you have personally that you think that you would want to present on trial?
Oh yeah, yeah, stand? That's easy. That's yeah. easy. Because we had, there was a it's a well-known story. There's a German television group out of Germany, biggest yeah. television station, ZF1. They contacted me out of the blue. They said, okay, we got somebody to debate you. I go, awesome. That's really, really great. Because it's really tough to get anyone from the science field to debate Flat Earth, because you don't want to be caught unprepared in a room with Flat Earth. Because if you look bad, you're never going to live it down.
Yeah.
So they got this guy from an astrophysicist out of Georgetown University. And they said, okay, come up with 5 questions for this guy, because we don't want you two talking directly, because physicists are notoriously dry and monosyllable. You know, it seems like the higher you get an education level, you lose your power of speech in most cases. I don't know why,
yeah.
but I don't want to get into it. So they said, give us 5 points. We will record it, give it to him, and then we'll just exchange videos back and forth. You guys will never talk to each other. Okay, great. Works for me. I don't care. Because yeah. I didn't want to, you know, make this guy feel bad. So the 5 points went as such. They're pretty brief. First point would be long-distance photography, which is if the curvature of the Earth is 8 inches per mile squared, which is 8 inches per mile, which means sooner or later, something going off into the distance, usually over water, it can be over land, but over water, is going to disappear, and it's going to go over the other side of the hill. It's going to go behind the curve. See what I did there?
Yeah.
And it's never going to, you're never going to see it again. It's gone. You cannot see over the side of a hill. You can't do it. But that's not the case anymore. 10 years ago, that absolutely was the case. But now we have HD technology built into cameras. And, you know, they're basically just little television cameras. Lenses don't have much to do with it anymore. You can zoom in, and a boat that used to be gone is now back in frame. And you can do this over and over, almost to the limit of the thickness of the atmosphere itself. You can see stuff upwards of 150 miles away. You should not be able to do that.
Yeah.
Second one would be gravity versus the vacuum of space. Who wins? And I had to boil this argument down. My initial speech, I had to change it because people just weren't getting it. It's like, okay, is there a second floor in your building right now?
No, not in mine, but yeah.
All right. Well, okay. Imagine your attic, right?
Right.
You turned your attic into a vacuum chamber, right?
Yeah.
Made it pretty solid. You put a cork in the ceiling, you pop that cork. What happens is absolutely instant. It's violent. The pressure will equalize. Pressure needs a container. It's one of the laws of thermodynamics, which is pressure cannot exist next to non-pressure without a barrier. Cannot happen.
Yeah.
And so that vacuum, I mean, in fact, you want to look up some fun stuff, look up some wonderful videos on YouTube. I think the Germans did it, called vacuum versus steel rail car. Steel, not aluminum. You apply a vacuum field to not even near 100% vacuum field to the inside of a steel rail car, it looks like it was got crushed by Godzilla, like yeah. that fast.
Wow.
So the question is, and you can do this a thousand of a thousand times, you pull the plug, that air is going to equalize right there in your house. So the question is, why did it equalize? Why didn't the gravity in your room right now keep the air in your room instead of going upstairs? And you're not really going to have an answer for this. It's okay. And so I say, okay, well, where does our atmosphere end and space begin? Because space is a much, much, much bigger, much more powerful vacuum chamber.
Yeah.
So where does the where's the bleeding edge of the atmosphere? And it's a pretty good question. Third one is the eclipse shadow. And I don't know where you were during the Great American Eclipse a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we were actually driving through, we're actually filming the documentary. So I think we stopped in I think we were either in Oregon or we're in Washington, actually. Might have been.
Oh, perfect. You probably pretty close to the same place I was. I was in Salem, Oregon with the documentary team. We drove down there for it. And it was a lot of fun. So we so the question is, now what's interesting is the blackout zone, you know, the blackout where you can actually see, you know, blackout shadow is only 70 miles wide.
Yeah.
But the moon is 2,000 miles wide. So why is the blackout zone so small? And in science can come up with all sorts of fun optics and say, well, it condenses down into this tiny little point, kind of like a reverse magnifying glass, but with a shadow. It's like, oh, okay, so why doesn't it happen when the Earth is in front of the sun? Meaning if the moon condenses down to a 70-mile wide shadow and the Earth is four times as wide as the moon, then the shadow, there should be a blackout zone on the moon that's 250-plus miles wide.
Yeah.
Never see it. It's always either a blood moon or waxing and waning crescents, you know, or a new moon, but it's never a big dot. I mean, the moon technically should turn into a giant eyeball. And never ever does. And it makes more sense for us because we say the moon is about 70 miles wide, give or take. I mean, it could be anywhere from 30 to 80. I don't know.
Yeah.
Fourth one is the moon temperature. And this is a really bizarre one that I didn't even know was a thing until the end of 2016, where someone called me up on a radio show and they said, yeah, by the way, the moon's cold. I go, okay, I don't even know what that means. And I go, it's colder at night? They go, no, man, it generates a cold light. I go, explain. It goes something like this. And you can test this with a $20 point-and-click infrared thermometer all day long. It's really easy to do. But so if it's 90 degrees in the sun, it's 80 degrees in the shade. We all know that whatever object blocks some of the sun's rays, therefore it's cooler in the shade.
Right.
However, with the moon, it's the exact opposite. Meaning if it's 50 degrees in the moon, it's 60 degrees plus in the moon shade, up to 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And just absolutely, and not only that, but you can take a magnifying glass to moonlight and even make it colder than that. And we've tested this with just about everything you can think of, and it's absolutely true. And no scientist will touch it with a 10-foot pole. Now, does it prove a flat Earth? Nope. Does it absolutely blow away the relationship between the sun and the moon? Because remember, the moon is only lit because it's reflecting the sun's rays.
Yeah.
But what we're saying is, no, it's absolutely self-illuminated. In fact, I didn't even know this was a thing. I had to start doing research on this, which was that the moon is actually a cold laser. It's generating a cold laser light. And it's something universities can do. You can change the frequency of a laser and make it colder. Now, it's not going to be like a Dr. Freeze, Batman, you know, Mr. Freeze, you know, ray like that.
Yeah.
But you could actually generate a colder light with, in fact, they use it for cosmetic surgery nowadays. So what the hell's that about? No scientist will touch that ever, ever, ever. And it's really weird because, again, lots of people have tested it themselves.
Yeah.
I can show you some wonderful videos. The last question was, the fifth point was the Van Allen radiation belt trap question. And I absolutely will take total credit for this one, which is, are the Van Allen radiation belts deadly? Yes or no? Simple question.
Yeah.
You say, yes, they are deadly, which is what they announced back in the 1950s. Then how did the Americans, with no shielding whatsoever that can stop radiation, make it round trips through the Van Allen belts? Nobody died. Nobody got radiation poisoning. Nobody even got cancer. Still five of these guys walking around today.
Yeah.
And remember, the only things that can stop radiation are gold, lead, and a whole bunch of water. And you can't use any of those on any sort of aerodynamic thing because you're not going to put an anchor on the top of a rocket.
Yeah.
And you say, well, okay, well, they're not that deadly then. And, you know, in fact, Stanton Friedman told me that one. And I said, oh, okay, then go to the NASA.gov website and look up a wonderful video they did called Orion Trial by Fire. Orion Trial by Fire, there's a video on it. It's still out there. It was made at the end of 2014, and NASA says that the Van Allen radiation belts are super, super deadly, and they haven't figured out how to solve it yet. And it's like, what are you talking about? So anyway, those five questions, I recorded, threw them at the Germans. They took them to the Georgetown guy. He folded instantly, like a card table, and that was it. The segment never aired, and the Germans went home angry. And ever since then, you know, that I it was something I built into a speech, but that, yeah, those are my five big bullet points. The number one, without a doubt, the one that most people use because it's so easy to test, is long distance photography.
Yeah.
Because in fact, I didn't even recommend that. I didn't come up with it. Somebody else said, oh, just go down to the beach, start shooting footage of lighthouses and boats and islands and stuff like that. And they never stopped. And that's what they've been doing basically for the last 5 years.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that, yeah, I mean, listening to all that, and I'm sure we'll have, you know, we'll have people that'll probably respond to those, you know, in the talkbacks and stuff that. I mean, that's, you know, and that's fine. I mean, I welcome that. And I'm sure you do too. And we'll get to that. That's another question I have for you towards the end of the interview. But yeah. One of the things I want to ask you is, cause you mentioned this on the documentary, and you've mentioned this, you know, I've watched, of course, some YouTube videos where you've been interviewed and some podcasts and things like that. And you mentioned, and again, I keep going back to the Earhart case because I'm sort of in bed with that for the last 15 years. But but even with that case and with really anything, like there's always, you know, you have like the overarching hypothesis or the theory, and then you have, everybody's got camps, right? Like inside the theory, like, oh, I believe they're almost sub theories within a theory. And then, you know, you talk about like, you know, the idea of a dome over the planet. There's like the infinite plane theory. There's a lot of different aspects and like kind of different directions that the theory kind of walks in. Mm-hmm. Has anybody... I mean, I guess, what is that like? Does that, you know, does that help or does that hinder? Does that, what does that do for the theory?
Actually not bad. It's not bad for us. I mean, it's rough when you're inside the community because, you know, I'm not a big fan of internal drama. Never have been. So watching people fight over that sort of stuff, it's okay, but most people don't see it as okay. But the reason is because it's better to have people bickering than being bored.
Yeah.
Meaning if they all agreed, then all of a sudden you'd have this, you know, it's like, oh, you know, just kind of laying around. What do we do now? But because they're always constantly refining and, you know, arguing or debating over certain points, it keeps it churning, keeps it going. And it also keeps the overall concept sort of has an ethereal property to it. So when people try to attack it, If you're trying to attack the Scottish Highlands, which is why I use them as a reference in the movie, who exactly do you go after? Because you don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, the majority of the people believe in a dome versus a no dome, but you still have to take that into account, and it kind of takes the impact out of your argument when you're trying to go after us.
Yeah.
So it's a weird little. I don't mind it at all, and it's not that bad. I mean. It's a pain when you have people, but like for example, we just did the big conference in Dallas this year.
Yeah.
And when you're there, we mostly put all that stuff away because it's a unified front when we're there. Now, when we're home, oh yeah, we'll make videos and people will debate all, you know, there's all sorts of rivalries and
sure.
Some bad blood. But when we're actually in person, most of that goes away.
Yeah. And so like, just for the people that, I mean, obviously the people that know about Flat Earth, you know, they get it as far as kind of like what the theory is or anything, but for people that may still not kind of get the whole idea of like, you know, the idea of this, like this dome, this ceiling, like I'm sure people have hit you with this question before, so I'd love for you to sort of elaborate or talk about it, but let's say like we're able to go outside and let's say we have the ability to do this, but let's say we launch a rocket into the sky.
Yeah.
And the rocket just infinitely goes up and we have the ability to do that. What happens to that rocket? Does it hit a ceiling cap?
Eventually. Yeah. Eventually it would run into something. Yeah. The question is, what does it run into? You know, that's one of the oldest questions. It's like, what is it? And I was like, man, I don't know. I mean, it could be all sorts of things. It could be a unified field. It could be an electromagnetic field. It could just be a straight up force field, heavy element, heavy water. I don't know, but whatever it is, the Americans and the Soviet Union tried to punch through it pretty much nonstop for 4 years. And they weren't even shy about it. They you know, all they said was, you can look it up, it's called the High Altitude Nuclear Test Program, where basically every atomic weapon we tested from 58 till 62 was aerial.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that. Most people think they were just ground bursts or underground stuff. No, 4 years, that's all they did. And that goes in line with what I would do. You know, when I looked at this, I tried to put myself in the other people's shoes, which is, okay, what would I do if I was a guy, if I was a government? It's like, well, here's a wall. Don't know who built it. Get the cannon, you know, and the cannon's not working. It's like, get the racket, you know, and you're hitting this thing as hard as you can. But the first three shots, and you could tell the first three shots were low megaton range. And this was back when megaton was a pricey option back in the day.
Yeah.
And after that, they were using mid kiloton weapons in the hundreds of kilotons, which is still way, way bigger than Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And they were basically just mapping the sky, trying to figure out where, you know, the dimensions of this thing. And it made sense to them. Yeah, why not? Let's do two things at once. Maybe we'll get lucky and punch through. At the very least, we can kind of figure out exactly where everything is. That way, when we send rockets up, we can just make them go horizontal as soon as possible,
yeah, or
the last minute, dump them off in the ocean and be done with it.
So, I mean, one of the most fascinating aspects of the theory is the idea, and one I really wanted to see elaborated more on in the documentary, is the idea of the Antarctic wall, because that's something that, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't really right off the bat associate with flat Earth. But I mean, you know, when you start talking about it, they kind of get an idea. But can you elaborate a little bit more on the idea of the Antarctic wall?
Yeah, I'd love to, because most people get that one wrong when they're first looking at it. And I don't blame them, is that most people, when they're looking at it from the outside, think that the coastline of Antarctica is the edge of the world. It's like, no, far from it.
Yeah,
the coastline of Antarctica is the beginning of the edge. The actual outer barrier would be thousands of miles inland. So what we're saying is, no matter what direction you go, you know, you're basically on a giant dinner plate. The only continent that doesn't look anything like the continent that we see in the maps is Antarctica, which has been sealed off for all time. You know, basically starting in 1959. Which was shortly after, you know, they started doing the atomic testing program, by the way. And literally in the same year they announced the Van Allen radiation belt was the year that the Antarctic Treaty came in and says that no corporation from any country can set up shop there ever, forever. It's the only unbroken treaty in the history of treaties. And it's not even up for review until 2041. And it's enforced by everyone, meaning, you know, it's the only thing literally in the world that every government, every economic power agrees on and signs. So if you started your own country tomorrow and, you know, call it Chrislandia, you were an economic power, you would get this piece of paper put in front of you. And it's like, you sign this. It's like, what is it? Well, you can't go down to Antarctica, you know, to set up shop. Now you can send tourists. You can go down there and have your picture taken with some penguins, but you cannot go and just start exploring randomly,
right?
Without, and it's the only piece of real estate, by the way, that's not owned by anybody. Also fascinating.
Yeah.
But anyway, it circles the entire thing, and the coastline would be the beginnings. The coast, and not only that, but even mainstream science claims it is the most unusual continent ever, because once you get off the beach, you know, usually it's basically snow and ice, like 200 feet straight up, not Game of Thrones high, but pretty high.
Yeah.
And then it turns into a plateau, basically a frozen plateau at 14,000 feet. And that's ridiculous. I mean, altitude sickness kicks in at half that. And most of the continent sits at 14,000 feet, at least the ones they even declare to us. The place just screams, go away.
Yeah.
So, and I think it's a wonderful design of this place, which is, it's basically a natural negative reinforcement that forces you to turn back on your own. It's not, it's be way different than if you were sitting there, it'd be these giant frost, you know, Vikings sitting there with axes, you know, the people would be just intrigued by that. They would just keep coming back. But if it's just miserable down there with snow and ice, eventually you'd be like, oh, it wasn't the icebergs and there's nothing to eat or drink. Let's just go home.
Yeah.
That's Antarctica.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's funny, like, as you're talking about this and as I've been kind of researching, you know, this particular conversation we're going to have, I mean, you know, I know you're not comfortable with this, but, you know, you sort of become like the spearhead of flat Earth in the last like 4 or 5 years, especially like this really big explosion. I don't have to tell you that. But for the people that are not familiar with it as much as you are, obviously, what's that been like for you to go from sort of just, you know, you mentioned it early in the conversation, relative, like, you know, anonymity to everyone wanting to sort of stick cameras in your face, ask you questions, interview you on shows like this one. What's that like for you?
I stopped fighting it, basically, in the beginning. And I wasn't kidding. I mean, everything I said in the documentary was true. I mean, the director still hated us by the end. Oh, no, the director, the producers are absolutely not flat earthers. They, by the time they got to the end, they just loathed us to no end. But what I wanted was, I wanted somebody else to take point. I really was hoping that Matt Boylan, you know, the otherwise known as Math Powerland.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was pretty dynamic, but it turns out he can't interview to save his life. And I didn't know this. And so when I started doing interviews, it seemed natural to me. To where, because I've done so much phone tech support work in my early career, when I was doing proprietary software training, that I didn't mind. You know, I've talked to all sorts of different people, and I can adjust my tone and my demeanor to no matter who I'm talking to. And what I've learned with media, I learned so much about media in the last 5 years. What I learned was if you can do a decent interview, you can do it consistently and get your bullet points off and not ruffle too many feathers, not just the hosts, but the producers. People don't realize it's not the hosts you got to worry about. It's the producers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That they'll just keep calling you. And people will steal from everybody. So people, there's lots of different podcasts that watch other podcasts and shows that watch other shows and so on. And there was this one producer that told me a radio show that was owned by Eminem up in Detroit. And he opened up the phone lines and it got urban nuts for a while there. I mean, people were yelling. Oh my God. They were cursing. It was a serious radio thing. And so they could yell and swear at me. And when the phone calls were over, the producer comes on. He goes, "I'm so glad you didn't hang up." He goes, "You did great." And I go, "Really? I thought it was awful." And he goes, "No, you don't get it." He goes, "It doesn't matter whether you love or you hate a topic, as long as you're engaged in it. In fact, we like people to yell more about a topic. We have better ratings if people yell than say good things."
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, yeah, for me, it's weird, but I've gotten, I started out small enough that it's been a nice adjustment to it. You know, I started out with, you know, normal podcasts and then got into bigger things and
sure.
But yeah, when the Netflix thing came out, that got a little weird.
I can imagine. I mean, and ever since the Netflix thing dropped and just kind of as you've been doing, you know, larger medium platforms and things like that. I mean, the question is, do you think especially with this, there's been sort of something is brewed. It's really like a science versus conspiracy thing going on, especially with this topic specifically.
Oh yeah. 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 As a matter of fact, I've got a copy. I ordered a copy just so I would always have it. Back in 2015, National Geographic, and this was before they even called me and did a TV thing. Mm. They did a thing called, it was from March of 2015 called the War on Science.
Yeah.
And National Geographic, when we were sitting in the desert in California, and because I was married to him for a weekend and we were some stuff, and everyone else had left. All the flat earthers had gone, and it was just us, you know, me and six cameras. And they were asking me questions I'd never heard before, but the tone, and this is not going to go away anytime soon, which was, they said, okay, what happens if this gets outside of your control? And before I could even say, well, I don't think it's necessarily in my control, they said, what happens to medicine? What happens to technology? What happens to the world as we know it? Isn't it possible that flat Earth could be leading us to the next dark ages? Wow. I go, you just gave me the title of my new book.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. But they weren't alone. There's been the reason why, like, for example, you probably didn't hear this because you probably watched it on Netflix, the documentary.
I did. Yes.
The iTunes version had a director's commentary. And I listened to it just because I figured, might as well. And it was super, super boring until it got to the point where that 12-year-old kid walked up to the microphone and asked me a question.
Yeah, at the end. Yeah.
Yeah, towards the end.
Sure.
And the producer, the director, and the lead editor instantly, without even skipping a beat, said, yeah, this was the point where we decided to take a stand, you know, on the whole flat earth thing, notably against it. It's like, why? Because that 12-year-old kid. And it's like, what? It's all fun and games till you get the kids involved. It's like, what? I didn't recruit this kid.
Yeah.
But we keep seeing it more and more to where, and I know I'm rambling a little bit, but there was a CBS team down at Dallas, and I was sitting there talking to CBS. We were just going through the motions. And a 9-year-old girl, unsolicited, walks up to me with her family in the background and hands me a hand-drawn thing of the flat earth, right? With my name on it. And at that point, that's when the interview changed gears because as you can imagine, it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
What's happening here? And so that piece has not come out yet, but I guarantee before it's over, they are going to try to turn this, yeah, absolutely, into a us versus them, you know, science versus the, if you want to call it science deniers, that's fine. But I never, ever said I didn't like science. We're talking on science. I love science.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that science has taken liberties and leaps of faith because of a general abuse of power, like anybody does.
That's a good point you make. I want to sort of elaborate on that if we can't. What, because we know, obviously we know what that does to the people that are producing these films that are shooting with you and everything when they see things like that with kids coming up to you, asking you questions in a public forum, like on a convention or, you know, the 9-year-old you just mentioned. What does that do to you, though? That's got to be probably, regardless of what you think of the theory or not, if you're listening to this and you just flat out don't think it's, just don't buy it, or you flat out are all in,
right?
Things like that have to be incredibly powerful to you.
It is, but it isn't, because to steal the line from the Truman Show, which I love so much, which is, we believe that the world is presented to us.
Yeah.
And with kids, because the cement hasn't really hardened yet, in fact, that's why National Geographic got involved, was because of the U.gov survey, for example. I'll give you two quick examples. The U.gov survey, which was done by the British research team, you know, mainstream science team.
Yeah.
They contacted 10,000 Americans. So, what do you think about flat Earth? And, well, I sounded like Obama just then. Wow.
Yeah.
They realized as they were getting younger in demographics, the numbers started going up, and then it took a weird jump at the 18 to 24 year olds, where a full third, like 34%, were globe skeptical. And that was beyond the normal deviation. And that freaked a lot of scientists out. And now, as far as being powerful, no, not so much, because why, of course, you know, kids are more pliable. Plain and simple. No, they're not as, they aren't bombarded. Well, I mean, they are now, but two quick things. They're bombarded with media now that is, they give equal weight to, regardless of the source. In fact, there was a wonderful article about that, talking about reputation and credibility.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you have a YouTube channel that has 5 million subscribers, because it's coming across the same screen, that same little cell phone, that you're getting, you know, you're giving that the same weight as you would a 20-year veteran of mainstream news. Literally the same weight. In fact, if more of your friends follow that YouTube person with the 5 million subs, that person immediately has more credibility.
Yeah.
And we just kept seeing more and more of this. And the thing that got me was the under 18s, because you aren't allowed legally to poll them, but we saw them.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful, I could send you the link. There's a wonderful gamer channel out there called Asmongold.
Mm.
And he, you know, like anything, because kids are so lazy, they don't even play their own video games. They watch them.
Well, that's the truth.
Yeah, that just blows me away. It's like, you don't even want to play it? It's
yeah.
Like, no, it's hard.
Yeah.
So this guy goes on, and he, you know, he's got his little image in the corner, and he's playing Warcraft, and he's talking about all sorts of stuff. He's multitasking. And somebody in the chat talks about Flat Earth. He's, oh, okay, really? Yeah, let's do a straw poll right now. Pops up the straw poll app. The guy was really fast.
Yeah.
Is the world flat actually? Yes, no, ready, go. And the votes were coming in at about 120 a second, right? Just,
yeah.
At no point was Flat Earth losing, to where when he finally just cut it off, I think we were at 53%. And some people's like, well, there's trolling. It's like, really? So if they were trolling, why was it 90%?
Yeah.
You know, when they didn't have time to organize anything, this was literally within 10 seconds of him getting the comment and putting the straw poll up there. And yeah, I've done junior high newspapers. I've done high schools. In fact, I just did, real quick, I did a Portland State University. I was actually required. My last book is a required reading for a class there now.
Wow.
And I actually did a Skype presentation where once the question started, it never stopped. I mean, the class was only supposed to go an hour. It ran two. And nobody left. I didn't even see kids looking at their looking at their cell phones. They just lined up to the microphone. I was like, holy smokes.
So, I'm sure that's pretty common for you too. I mean, that's kind of like, because like, you know, when we, I mean, we haven't announced this show publicly yet that you're going to be on, because the show's sort of restructuring the show and recording right now. But like, the few folks, probably 40, 50 people that I reached out to and said, hey, you know, we're gonna talk to Mark instantly. I mean, just like, oh, I got questions. Like, can I ask more than one? It's, you know, it's like one of those types of deals that people just want to naturally. They just naturally gravitate toward curiosity, I think. Just everything.
And I think the reason why the teacher let it run as long is because millennials and Gen Zs, no offense to wherever one you fall into.
Yeah.
They're, a lot of them aren't really great at engaging in person. It's usually text. And this inspires. I sat it with some kids down in Florida. One was 15, one was 20.
Yeah.
And these kids were usually buried in their phones. And the second they heard Flat Earth, it's like, oh, I got questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think that's natural. I mean, you know, in we're talking about social media, talking about YouTube, which I know you're very prominent on. You have a channel, which again, we'll link to in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
It's a melting pot, right? Like not only for conspiracy, but just for anyone with belief in anything really. I mean, you know, social media is a big deal. Does social media, I guess it's another question to kind of throw back to the one I asked earlier, but does it help or does it hinder? Is it both? What does it do?
It helps. I don't think it's ever hindered us because before social media, it took a lot longer for people to even talk about stuff. I mean, you know, the moon missions, for example, the American Apollo program was under scrutiny for years between, you know, when they quit in 1970 up until the internet really started cranking up in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Up in that gap, that 30-year gap, hardly, where are you going to get the word out? Where are you going to go? UFO convention? You could write a book, but who's going to buy it? Social right. media has given people access to the ultimate library. I mean, it's the informational tool that gods.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like the rest of our future has kind of been stunted or taken from us. You know, where are our flying cars? Where's the Jetsons? Where are our robot servants?
Yeah.
But when it comes to information, oh yeah, we have everything. I mean, you know, we have access to, with the exception of classified documents.
Yeah.
We have access to everything. So no, social media has been a godsend. Mm. And I think deliberately so. I mean, you know, when Google bought YouTube, you know, they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and which, well, a few more points and then we'll kind of get into the user submitted questions, but I on a personal standpoint, I mean, I know you have a lot of support. Of course you have your share of detractors, which you're very open about. My question, I guess, here is just from a personal standpoint. And I don't know if anyone's ever asked this actually before. At least I haven't heard it yet, but, doesn't mean it hasn't been asked. Sure. Do you ever, I mean, you have a lot of support. I understand that, but I mean, have you ever felt solitary or even sort of like, you know, kind of alone in trying to explain the platform, the movement? Does it ever get hard for you?
No, no. As a matter of fact, with this, there were so many people that started getting into it right away, and the numbers just started cranking up and up and up and up. Mm. That, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, I lost, you know, there's some family members that won't talk to me, my sister included. Mm. But at the same time, I gained so many friends.
Yeah.
That I never would have thought, you know, from all different walks of life, and we all share the same thing. I mean, not to say that the Dallas conference was a big love fest, but in a lot of ways it is. You know, we people, you know, they stay up as late as they can. Hardly anyone sleeps for the amount of time they're if they're not listening to the sessions that are happening on, they're talking at the lobby. If they're not talking in the lobby, they're talking in the bar. Yeah. Meetups always run long. So no, it's never been, in fact, it's the opposite of the whole alone thing. I've never felt alone doing this.
Yeah.
I felt, you know, the only thing I can say is I felt unsure early on because like anything, it's like, well, I'm putting myself out there, but I'm doing it for a reason, but I fully prepared. It's like, well, I just want an answer to my questions.
Yeah.
And if I get, you know, if somebody says, oh, okay, here's why, then I'd be, oh, okay, YouTube channel gone. And that would be it.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a YouTube channel for a number of years and never even made a video.
Yeah.
You know, like most people, you know, you're on there to view, you have your account just to view stuff. And
right.
Once the numbers started ratcheting up, it's like, holy smokes. And then other people that start getting into behind me, their numbers, I mean, yeah, my YouTube channel's fine, but there were people that were, you know, 2, 3, 5 times bigger than me.
Yeah.
That we're getting into. I was like, okay. So.
I mean, I guess a follow-up to that question is, and you touched on it earlier, you know, like people confronting you being adversarial on some points, like when you're on the radio station and things like that. I mean, is with what you do and kind of, you know, what you sort of been working on for the past several years, is there a need to feel almost sort of, for lack of a better term, like bulletproof to all the things people say about you or the theory, or even when you're just confronted with opposition just in general?
For me, it's a little easier because, well, one, you know, when you do enough high-level tech support, you've heard it. It's
yeah.
like, look, it's really different. When somebody pays $50,000 for your software,
yeah,
and something, and it's tied to payroll.
Yeah, right there with you.
And it breaks on a payroll day.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you get really used. I mean, I had a fixer call me once. Like, you better take care of this really soon, or I'm gonna get on a plane. It's like, really? Bring it on, man.
Yeah.
love to see it. The fact that you're telling me this on an open line, super genius.
Yeah.
But no. The big thing is when people say, why don't you get mad when, cause I seriously, people open up and they'll go on the attack pretty quickly.
Yeah, sure.
With me. And I say, why would I get mad? I used to be them. I go, yeah. It's completely hypocritical. I mean, nobody gets into, everyone forgets this. Everyone forgets the journey. It's like it was like before Flat Earth and then after Flat Earth.
Yeah, sure.
And everyone forgets what it took to get there. It's like, how can I yell at them? I go, it's absolutely hypocritical. If I yell at them, I'm absolutely forgetting what it took. I know what the pain they're going through. I know why they're angry, and they're not angry at me. Don't hate the player, hate the game.
Sure, yeah.
That's what it is. I've told people, you know, that are really, you know, I there was a girl in Dublin, chemistry major, and her face started getting red.
Yeah.
And I go, do you even understand? I was calm as could be. It's like, I mean, my blood pressure was a little up, but you know, she was making me nervous. It was like, my God, yeah. I have health issues.
Yeah.
And I said, do you even know why you're angry right now? You're not angry at me. You're angry at the idea. And it's like, so what I've told people, which is why I don't get any threats.
Sure.
It's like, look, you can kill me tomorrow, or I could die in a bus crash tomorrow. And it's not going to harm the idea at all, because the idea is separate.
Yeah, it's almost like that moment in The Dark Knight. I keep kind of going back to that as you're talking. Like, you know, when he says Joker says to Batman, you know, you have nothing to threaten me with. There's nothing you can do. Nothing to do with all your strength, and nothing to do with all your anger or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So. His tools. It's almost like he was the wrong hero for the job.
Yeah.
Because yeah, you're absolutely right. And by the way, greatest comic book movie in history. And
yeah, agreed.
Coincidentally, I just watched The Joker.
What'd you think of it?
I can see why it was as polarizing as it was. I mean, it was, the question is, did it need to be done?
Right.
I mean, as far as origin stories goes, heck, dark.
Yeah, yeah.
Dark, violent, nothing. I can see why DC didn't put their label on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, it's not something you take the kids to.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So what's the Joker? Really? Pam, bam, zip, you know, we're gonna do that? Nope. I mean, the only gratuitous thing you got was you got to see a child Bruce Wayne. That's all you got.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was brilliantly done, though. Yeah.
Oh no, I'm not knocking it. I'm a big fan of the movie review site overseas called The Critical Drinker.
I've actually heard of that.
If you get a chance, he saw it, and it's like I thought it was a you know, was it necessary? No, but I mean, considering what happened, I mean, hell, I mean, watching De Niro get shot at point blank on stage, it's amazing. But anyway, to your point, yes, you're absolutely right. All the skills, you know, what can you do to me? There's nothing, attacking me will not help you at all. And so because of that, most people don't get attacked directly. The only people that get attacked in Flat Earth are the ones that go after the trolls.
Yeah.
The ones that it's like, do not, that should be an internet t-shirt. I'm sure it is. Don't feed the trolls.
Yeah. Don't engage. Know? Yeah.
Because they will, once you feed them, they will come at you and they will never stop.
Yeah.
And so I don't, for the most part, or if I do, I don't. I also, by the way, don't read, because I want to actually sleep at night. I don't read 90% of the YouTube comments.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine that. Because
because it's brutal. Let me get this one thing in,
which is
when it comes to YouTube, people forget. And this is the advice for anybody that's doing stuff on YouTube. You've got to remember that the trolls have been there since the internet forums were created back in the 90s. I mean, seriously, I could make a video with the most wonderful, wonderfully benign music, with kittens and puppies playing in a children's cancer ward.
Yeah.
And within 100 hits, you're going to get somebody walking in there going, this is effing gay, thumbs down, unsubbed, I hate you and your God.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
You're not wrong. Yeah.
No. And then it gets worse from there.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, speaking of this, I mean, you mentioned earlier about you told the story about the you know, asking the five questions and then sort of that whole thing. I mean, if somebody, and maybe this has been done, if somebody would ask you if they would arrange, I mean, a public ability, would you debate someone on stage live, like some like a Neil deGrasse Tyson or someone like that?
It's the beginning of my my weekly podcast, which is, in fact I could read it for you. Hang on. Okay. I've been saying this for 3 years now.
Yeah.
And sorry, hang on. It is
take your time.
Strange World. It is the Mark Sargent 2020 challenge is in effect. This is my personal declaration of war against mainstream science. I, Mark Sargent, hereby put forth a challenge to any university, foreign or domestic, to loan me a self-contained spacesuit, put me in a vacuum chamber and pull the switch. Find out what happens. That's just one line. It used to be, before the vacuum chamber test, it used to be just a debate with scientists.
Yeah.
No, I'd be happy to, but they're not going to.
Yeah.
The reason is, and I've talked to certain people in the academic world, and they said, do you know how much money and time it takes to get a freaking master's degree in a physical science?
Yeah.
You know, once you get to that point, the only thing you care about, especially if you get your PhD, is you care about being published and you care about your peer groups.
Yeah.
You do not want to get caught. It's kind of like, I hate to seem like it's an elitist thing, like a fraternity type deal.
Right.
But do you really want to, what will it benefit you to argue somebody in flat earth?
Yeah.
Because it's like a boxing match. If you don't take them out in the first round, you've already lost.
Yeah.
In your peer groups. Because the peer groups is coming out, just like, why haven't you taken them down? Why are they still standing? Why are they still standing? They're not looking at flat earth anymore. They're looking at you.
Right.
And it's too big of a risk. And so they don't. I've gotten to debate a couple scientists, but not the ones I want. I mean, you know, here's the other thing. There's so few public scientists in the world.
Yeah.
They're in front of the camera. I mean, literally the top three, and you know them. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson, number one with a bullet.
Right.
Brian Cox from England.
Sure.
Michio Kaku from Japan. That's really it. And if you want to throw in Bill Nye, you can, but he's not a scientist. He's just a guy. He's just a guy that a nerd that, by the way, that's a great point, which is I even did a clue on him where he keeps getting drugged in front of the camera because producers know that the average person doesn't know any different.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, he's got that bow tie and lab coat and he looks like a nerd. Therefore he must, you know, be some sort of scientist. No. He's got a bachelor's in mechanical and he went straight into acting. But because he's good on camera, he gets to be on every forum you can think of.
Who's your dream debate? If you could pick one, who's your dream debate? If you could have a debate tomorrow, they fly out to wherever it's going to be, who are you wanting to pick?
Realistically, or sure. You mean like in a, like my fantasy?
Yeah. Like your dream debate. Like if you could just hand pick anyone, you know, either the three or four that you mentioned or anyone else that you could debate tomorrow on stage.
Neil Tyson, because his stage presence is so good. People don't realize that his gift, and there's a reason he's never done a debate in his life ever, ever, ever. And the reason is because he is very tailored to his job. He is a wonderful stage speaker.
Yeah,
if it wasn't physics, he could do it for anything. I mean, he could have been a stand-up comedian. I mean, every time I see him on stage, and it's not a racial thing, he reminds me of a cross between Bill Cosby and Sinbad.
Yeah,
he's got that jovial, he's got that charisma, he's got some wonderful inflection when he's talking about things, and he can make anything, including general astronomy, which is really, really boring. He can make it, you know, seem very, very compelling.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Neil Tyson, Michio Kaku is way too abrasive. He hates conspiracy people. I don't know what it is with him, but man, he just braces against it and he gets ugly.
Yeah.
And Brian Cox, he just has that whole British indignant thing going.
Yeah.
Where the other guy I'd love to talk to, even though he's not a scientist, would be Elon Musk.
Yeah, that's one of the questions on the user submitted questions we're going to get to in a bit.
Oh, okay, then I won't.
We'll get to Elon in just a minute. I just okay. You know, I want to ask you sort of like, you know, you've been on this journey. You know, the documentary drops. You know, you're all over the place. You're doing all these interviews. What are your reflections thus far? If you look back on the documentary, kind of how it's changed your life, kind of what's all the stuff you've done. Give us some of the reflections so far on everything.
It's the last, you know, because my clues are going to be 5 years old next month. It has been a weird mix of organic growth and these media, just unusually unique media spikes.
Yeah.
So like in 2015, we were lucky to get any media attention at all. There was this little blurb when Kent Hovind, if you remember who that guy is.
Yeah, sure.
He got out of prison and they were asking him about Flat Earth. Forbes magazine was asking him. And it reminded me of that Han Solo thing when he came out of the carbonite.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, what? I've gone for a little while. Everyone has delusions of grandeur. That's what it felt like. It's like, what? How long have I been gone? Yeah. Like, people are talking about Flat Earth now?
Yeah.
And so, but then 2016, you had rapper B.O.B.
Yeah.
Do that song and an album dedicated to the Flat Earth concept. And Neil Tyson responded on Comedy Central, and that was just ratings gold.
I mean,
a Grammy nominee versus the most popular scientist in the world. It's like that just, I couldn't have written that.
Yeah.
And that carried through 2016. And then Kyrie Irving did his thing at the beginning of 2017, which was mind blowing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm watching LeBron, you know, during a press conference, ask Kyrie about Flat Earth. I'm just going, I could have walked up to LeBron with a briefcase, $5 million in it. He still wouldn't have said it. You said it for freaking free.
Yeah.
And then the documentary in 2018, and then Mad Mike and the other stuff. But it's those media spikes that what happens is people, it exposes a lot different demographics to it. And there's so much content to go back on, but it just keeps getting weirder, and the snowball keeps getting bigger as it rolls downhill. So where I noticed the weirdest surreal moment for me was when I was going to some of the film festivals before it was picked up by Netflix and iTunes and those guys. You know, with anything people don't know, it's like, you know, there's tons of films, thousands and thousands of films made every year.
But
if you don't have a producer, you know, if you don't have somebody to distribute it,
who's gonna ever see it?
So like, we went to the Toronto Film Festival, and you basically pitch it around Toronto film festivals, and then the heavy hitters, Netflix and other people, they go there and they say, yeah, I want to talk to those guys that made that film, and then they put it on their thing. And I was sitting there, and I had a hat on and glass. I didn't want to be seen, right? But I was sitting in some of these audiences, and the same thing kept happening in different audiences at different film festivals, which was, for the first 20 minutes, nobody even thought it was real.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, and then all of a sudden, by about the 25-minute, 30-minute mark, because they thought that was a piece of docufiction, and then all of a sudden, you could see everyone talking to each other simultaneously in the theater, going, wait a minute, there's something really big and scary on the internet, and I don't know about it.
Yeah.
I mean, some weird, everyone thinks they've got a good bead on what's happening on the internet.
Right.
And then you see something like this. The perfect example would be when they showed a cut of this to an editor in Hollywood. It was a friend of, and the guy didn't know anything about anything. And they go, just watch this. We're not going to give you any context. Just watch it. He watches the whole thing. At the end, he goes, where did you get the budget for this thing? He goes, you guys have been holding out on me. I was like, what are you talking about? And it's like, well, where'd you get all these actors? They played it so straight. And the guy literally thought, he goes, no, man, that was real. And then, you know, his pupils just dilated. Yeah. And he's like, wait, that conference in Raleigh, that actually happened? He goes, yeah, dude, we were there for 3 days. And that just kept happening more and more. And so that's when I knew that we really, really had something.
Yeah.
Because the concept is so, it's kind of like the English language. Easy to understand, grasp, difficult to master.
Right.
You know, there's people in Flat Earth that have been doing it for 2-3 years. They still don't have a lot of the bullet points. But you can understand the concept very, very quickly. Oh yeah, Flat Earth. I've yet to find a single person that when you bring it up to somebody, they don't know what it is. It's like, Flat Earth, never heard of it.
Yeah.
Almost nobody also is on the fence. You either into it or you're not into it.
Very few
people have ever said, you know, oh yeah, by the way, you know, so, you know, I can take it or leave it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you touched on this earlier, but I mean, one of the things, you know, really, I commend you for so much is your, just your openness and your willingness to discuss, you know, the theory, discuss your personal history with it. Yeah. Even with people that flat out just don't agree, you know, to say, no, it's a bunch of BS or whatever, but well, you know.
Well, yeah. And why, again, why, how can I judge them? I was more stubborn than most. I mean, I literally hammered on this thing for 9 freaking months. So when somebody has a problem in the first couple days,
like, yeah.
You know, in fact, the first chapter of the book that I just put out, called Flat Earth Clues Into the World, inspired by the National Geographic thing, first chapter is literally called Look Away, which is, and I know it's not really reverse psychology. It is like, look, if you wake up every day, your life is awesome, and you think you got a good beat on things, stealing from Men in Black, don't look at this. Because if you look at this, it is a rabbit hole that eventually, it's a rabbit hole that you can't turn back from once you get to a certain point.
Yeah.
Once you get, if you get into it, you're into it. That's it. I mean, yeah, of course, we've had members that have left gone, but that's just because their enthusiasm, they just got burned out.
Right.
But our retention rate is higher than any organized religion at this point. And so it's like, okay.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh, and this has been great. I want to wrap up and then get into a few user
questions. Sure.
The last question I want to ask you, I think for the night though, for me personally, is how do you see this ending for you personally?
Well, it really depends. I mean, my hope is that eventually this thing hits critical mass, like the famous science experiment which they love condemning, called the Hunter the Monkey effect. Which is, you know, once a certain amount of the population absorbs this, then everybody gets it. Meaning, you know, there's this tipping point where it's actually more acceptable to have an opinion or be somewhat accepting of it than it is to go against it.
Yeah.
At that stage, I don't know what happens. I mean, you know, kind of an uncharted territory, but I can tell you my initial worries that there'd be, you know, some psychological effect where, you know, 1% of the population would lose their minds, you know, because I've had people say, look, you're making the universe very claustrophobic. But nobody flipped out. You know, nobody burned down a library, and nobody, you know, we've had hundreds of meetups and there's been no violence, and it seems to be a very, very positive, peaceful thing.
Yeah.
So I'd like to think that potentially it transforms what we know and what we're willing to accept at face value and make us a little more, you know, not necessarily skeptical, but a little more introspective about why we believe what we believe.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hoping for. You know, the thing I joke is, it's like, well, either it's going to turn into a new golden age or the apocalypse.
Yeah.
One of those two. And I don't think it's up to me which road it goes.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay. That's a good ending to the night. So, I mean, I want to ask you sort of a few user questions here. I mean, like I said, we've, you know, alluded to it a couple times. I mean, people were excited to ask you questions. You know, they were curious naturally. There's people that obviously doubt. Some of these questions are very straightforward. Some of them are a little more complex, but we'll get through them. Hopefully just a few here. Destiny wanted to know if the earth is flat, why doesn't a boat just fall off the side?
Believe it or not, and there are no stupid questions. Yeah. I have heard that question many times.
Sure, I'm sure you have.
Because we've all seen, and that's because of the conditioning. We've all seen that wonderful flat Earth image of basically a flat Earth frisbee flying in space.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you got to give up more than that, unfortunately. Which is, why is there space at all? We don't even say there's space. So the reason why a boat doesn't fall off is the same reason why a boat doesn't fall off when you're in the middle of a lake. There's an edge around the entire outside of this thing. It's not like a cosmic waterfall. Thor did us no favors with Asgard, which is you're basically in a building, and inside that building is a giant saltwater lake, and inside that saltwater lake are a few islands, which we call continents, and that's basically it. So that's why the boat doesn't go anywhere.
Makes sense. Okay. So Kevin wanted to ask you, have you, and I think there is allusion to this in the documentary a little bit. Have you or anyone in the group mounted an expedition to where you believe that Antarctic wall is?
No. And again, the Antarctic wall, it's not the Antarctic wall, which is the coastline of most of Antarctica.
Yeah.
That isn't the edge.
Right.
You can go if you want to spend $15,000. I think that's what American dollars is, 15 grand. You can go to Antarctica right now. and take some pictures. They'll put you in an orange vest and it's really cold and miserable, and you can have some penguins come up to you and feed them, I think. But that's it. I mean, that's all you can do. So yeah. No, we haven't mounted an expedition because the treaty, and I can send you a PDF. You can find a PDF online. It's really easy.
Sure.
The treaty is bulletproof, meaning you can't go anywhere. The permits to go anywhere in the interior of Antarctica take huge amounts of non-refundable money.
Yeah.
And and they have to be approved by multiple countries, which doesn't make any damn sense.
Yeah.
So no, nobody's mounted an expedition out there.
Now, regarding the Antarctic wall, we have a second question. Justin wanted to know why if 14,000 feet, and I know that number well. That's actually the altitude record that Earhart broke when she was flying. Why can't we see the Antarctic wall from if it's a 14,000 foot
that's
cliff?
Pretty good. No, and that's also a common question. Again, the average person does not, and look, I was one of these people too. The average person, the reason why the illusion has been so good over the last few years, last 50 years, is because most people don't have any sort of understanding of engineering or chemistry or physics, or there's a fourth one. Can't remember what it was. I'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah.
But it goes with the thickness of the atmosphere, which is okay. Why can't we see Japan from California? Why can't we see Europe from New York? And why can't we see Mount Everest from everywhere?
Yeah.
Because Mount Everest is the highest place. You should be able to see it from freaking everywhere. And if the atmosphere wasn't as thick as it is, yeah, you might be able to. You got to remember, what we're breathing in is less than 20% oxygen. It's mostly nitrogen.
Yeah.
God help us if a nitrogen-based group shows up. So because of that, it's thick. The thickness compounds over time. And so you can only see so far before it just gets blurred out, because you're basically looking through a thin version of water. No different than why doesn't a scuba diver, will you take the extreme one, a scuba diver loses the sun entirely at less than 200 feet. You know, the sun could be high noon, you know, on a beautiful summer day. You cannot see the sun 200 feet down. In fact, at 90 feet, you lose all shades of color except for blue.
Yeah.
Same thing. The atmosphere you're breathing in right now is just basically a soup. It's just a thin version of that. So at 150 miles, that's pretty much the limit at sea level. You can't see any further anyway, because there's just too damn thick.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned we touched on Elon Musk. So Sam wanted me to ask you, and I know a little bit more, but I know your opinion a little bit on NASA. You've talked a little bit about that in public forums and things. NASA, but let's talk about SpaceX. Like, what's your opinion on SpaceX, Elon Musk, what they're doing?
Okay, I will try not to drag this one out, because I when I was writing this, I did a chapter called Enemies of the State, and Elon Musk is in it, and I was surprised how much I kept typing in there. Because Elon, there was a New York Post article that came out last year, and it basically said, the headline said, Elon Musk is a total fraud. And I absolutely agreed. And here's why. Not blaming people. Look, we believe what's out there. It's like, if you ask the average person on the street who founded Tesla Motors, they will immediately jump on. It's like, oh, it's Elon Musk. No.
Yeah. No.
He just bought Tesla Motors. He made his money in PayPal. I will give him credit for being a programmer, and he bought Tesla Motors, and then a very nice toupee. But after that, I mean, like, Mark Cuban didn't found the Dallas Mavericks. Ray Kroc didn't found McDonald's. That just
happened.
But everything he has ever promised to do, he never ever did. You know, I'm going to solve Puerto Rico's power problems after the storm with my solar thing. I'm going to save those kids in that cave with my submarine.
Right.
Underground super rail car from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Super plane that's going to go from the United States to China in a couple hours, cost as much as a business class ticket. Or one of my favorites, which blew me away, was in 2017. We said, oh yeah, we're going to send two people around the moon and back middle of 2018.
Yeah.
And I'm going, and I'm looking, and it's February of 2017. I'm going, what sort of aggressive timeline is this? Is the worst thing ever. And so then he's never, ever done anything. And now he says, oh yeah, we're going to, he's doing this thing with this Japanese billionaire. It's like, oh, we're going to take like 12 people around the moon now, and they're all going to have easels. They're going to paint the moon as we go around. I'm going, yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But so when somebody sent me the snapshot of the Tesla Roadster in space, I go, oh, who photoshopped that? I go, is that Jaron? Was that Bob? Who did that? They go, no, man, that's a live stream. And I go, what? A live stream. And I click on this, and people don't, again, because people don't understand general physics, they don't understand what was wrong with that car. You know, it's like, there was so many, it's like, that was supposedly a car straight out of his garage, wasn't prepped for space or anything like that. And all the pressurized systems in that thing should have detonated instantly. The tires would have blown, the fiberglass would have been shredded, everything would have warped and buckled. The glass would have spiderwebbed, you know, from the temperature swings. It would just been disaster. The thing would have been, and it was absolutely pristine. But you know the part that bugged me more than anything?
What's that?
Was that we're talking about two companies here. One's a public company, one's a private company, right? Tesla and SpaceX.
SpaceX, yeah.
And yet there were no logos anywhere in that car. None to be found. As a matter of fact, that thing should have, I don't know where you are, should have looked like NASCAR. That thing should have been wall-to-wall endorsements. In fact, why did you use the convertible in the first place? Why didn't you use your flagship, the S Series, which everybody has, the four-door? In fact, all you had to do instead of that generic mannequin, which also didn't have any logos, my God, you could have sold the rights to Disney. He could, because they own everything. It could have put Boba Fett, a Stormtrooper, Groot, and Iron Man in the four seats. Thing would have paid for itself.
Yeah.
So, no, SpaceX does absolutely nothing, never has. As a matter of fact, you know, so when they say, oh, yeah, we're going to go to the moon in a couple of years, it's like, no, it's just apparently, and I know it's just the way we are, when you have $1 billion and you talk to the press, they will put it, they will publish it, no matter what. In fact, the more outlandish it is, the more they will let you talk.
Yeah.
Like, he's never done anything. Ever, ever, ever. Sorry.
That's a good argument. I mean, the next question is, Tim actually wanted me to ask you this, and it's a good question, and I think it'll be interesting to see kind of what your response is to this. But you're from your standpoint, is there an understanding? Is there any empathy as to why like people that I guess don't believe or have a hard time believing that the earth is flat and sort of coming over to the
other side. Oh, yeah, it's a huge
paradigm. There empathy there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, total empathy there. In fact, that's one of the reasons I get to do what I do, because I have the empathy.
Yeah.
I realize that, you know, there's this wonderful line from The Matrix, which is, we never free minds after a certain age because they just can't take it. And in this case, there was a guy that called up it wasn't Coast to Coast, it was Ground Zero. And he says, and his father, he said, my father worked for NASA, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, how dare you? How dare you tell me the world isn't what I think it is? And that's the big point here. It's like with all, just about any other conspiracy, you can hide secrets in the desert, right? If you don't want to think about other conspiracies, you don't have to think about them.
Yeah.
But with flat earth, you're talking about where you are right now. And you can't, it's something you can't run away from. You can't hide from it. I mean, you can kind of block it out of your mind for a little while if you want. So when people get, you know, I've seen the five stages of acceptance. I have full empathy for people. So it means literally denial and anger right off the bat for so many people, because it's like, no, that's idiotic. And then they start calling you names. I mean, I had a cousin who has never sent a bad word to me in her life. Starts shooting me profanity emails. It's like, where did this come from? And that's because it is so freaking polarizing. Let me end this part on that, which is when people make flat earth videos in YouTube, sometimes it's clickbait because, you know, they look at the trends and they see, oh, wow. It's not that your hits will go up if you make a flat earth video, but your comments will multiply by 5 times easily. Because they're just these Donnybrooks that just happen in the comment sections where people just go. I mean, people will fight about anything anyway, but with flat earth, they just tear into each other. So no, I have no, people get mad. No, I have no problem. They get mad all they want. And it's always worked out for me because the people who get, I've seen people get really, really upset and then turn around. One more thing.
No,
they'll make flat earth videos and they'll say like 4 flat earth videos in a row. Like, and they'll say flat earth is stupid, flat earth is retarded, flat earth is dumb. And all of a sudden, like the fifth video, they'll be like, hey, you know what? Flat earth isn't so bad. And they'll leave the other ones there. And it's like, why'd you leave those? Ah, who cares? I'm in flat earth now. It's like, wow.
Yeah. So, another good question, I think, and I'm sure you've answered this one. Addie wants to know: is there a bottom side of the Earth?
Don't know, and that leads into. In fact, that was the Jimmy Kimmel guys were asking that at the conference.
I saw that too. Yeah,
yeah. I didn't know if he was actually going to run it, but whatever. He ran a freaking nine-minute segment during the monologue. I'll take it.
Yeah.
which was. We don't know because we can't dig down that deep. In fact, mainstream science has been really quick. You know, every good flat earther knows is like, what's the deepest hole ever drilled? 8 miles.
Yeah.
So if mainstream science can't dig down 8 miles, how do we? In fact, the bigger question is, how do you know what's inside a globe if you can only dig down 8 miles?
Yeah.
You know, we've all seen, again, the artist's illustrations, and that's all they are. You know, these wonderful 1,000-mile bands, you know, red and orange and yellow and white. It's like, how do you know that?
Yeah.
And if you look at the small print, that's what kills me. And the small print, science says, yeah, we have absolutely no idea what's going on down there. But yeah. But this is our best guess. And it's like, well, so you're just not going to. But, you know, when you see that when you're 9 and then you see this when you're a senior in high school.
Right.
You'll defend it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's a good point. Okay, we can go on. Our last question of the night is going to be submitted actually from my co-host for Vanished, Jennifer. So she wanted me to ask you, and you might have been asked this again as well, what about GPS, satellite imagery? How does that factor in? I mean, GPS, global positioning satellite, what do we do?
Okay, first off, the GPS system, and I covered this in a clue, which I thought I did as much research as I could, but GPS, of course, is a military system, you know, global position, built in the 90s by the U.S.,
right.
And when it comes to the images itself, you know, as far as, you know, it's like, well, how do we get the stuff on Google Earth? It's like, well, the stuff that's stitched together on Google Earth, most of it you can get from spy planes or, you know, commercial airliners if you want to get lazy, kind of like what they did with some of the Uber drivers, and, you know, where they put cameras on top of cars and let them drive around.
Right.
But you can, you know, at 20 miles up, you can get, most people cannot tell the difference. In fact, what is the difference? When you're at 20 miles, a shot that's taken from 20 miles and something that's taken a little bit higher, you can call it a satellite if you want. And then that's all you do. You zoom out from that, stitch it together, bingo, there's your satellite imagery. It's to be fair, do I think there's satellites? Because a lot of people, this is one of the disagreements in the flyers community. Do I think there's satellites? Yes, I do. I think that most of them are launched on rockets? No, I do not, because, again, I didn't know this either. Look up the high-altitude balloon program from NASA, and they're not shy about this. This is not something secret. NASA is the world's largest consumer of helium. They launch balloons every hour of every day and have since the 1950s because it's just cheaper. They can, in fact, they can launch stuff, what's the biggest payload? 4 tons, 8,000 pounds. That's huge. If you can do an 8,000-pound payload on a balloon, why the hell would you do anything with rockets? I mean, yeah, I'm sure they do some rockets, but I think it's mostly for show.
Yeah. All right. This has been an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed talking with you tonight. Where can people learn more? Can you plug the book, the documentary, websites, all that jazz?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the documentary is called Behind the Curve. You can find it anywhere. Just type in Behind the Curve. You'll find it. It's on Netflix and Amazon and iTunes and all those. The book is called Flat Earth Clues, End of the World, and you can pick that up anywhere. There's an audio version on Audible, and you can find that anywhere. But the main webs or the main YouTube channel is just my name, Mark K. Sargent, or you can just type in Flat Earth Mark and you'll find it. That's probably the easiest way to get it out there. And again, take everything I say with a grain of salt. Don't, you know, do your own research, ask questions. I'm not here to convince you. I'm not here to persuade you. I'm just here to get you to think about a few things that maybe you haven't thought about, and through it, you know, make up your own mind.
Mark, this has been a pleasure. I appreciate you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle Me My Friends Pod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle at Me and My Friends Pod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original song Succubus by producer Redman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2020. All rights reserved.